Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss the stigma of mental illness. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and this year the National Alliance on Mental Illness has chosen the theme Cure Stigma. Studies show 1 in 5 American adults battle mental illness, and one of the main reasons some do not seek professional help is stigma. Joining us today is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
All right, so let's start with where the term stigma comes from. Mark, you did a little research on this.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing, and I think where the derivation of the term speaks to the deep emotional significance of it. The Greeks first used it, and they decided that they wanted to categorize people on sight so that they would have a ready mechanism of determining who was moral, who was good, who was acceptable, versus who was a criminal, who was a bad person, who did something wrong. They wanted to know that on sight. So what they would do is they would brand the person with a sign of some sort or a design of some sort that was cut or burned into the person's body. And that advertised the bearer as being a slave, a criminal, or a traitor, for instance. And it was that person was a blemished person who was really polluted and should be avoided, especially in public places. So the stigmatized individual is reduced in our minds to not a whole person, to just being the characteristic of the stigma. It takes away their humanity. You have the connection of you don't have to treat them in a humanely way, in a human regarding way. They are less than, they are the other, they are to be avoided, they're to be shamed. All those things are part of the term stigma. I think the derivation does speak to the toxic aspect of this phenomenon that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah. Now, the idea that mental illness is shameful can not only come from others, but from people who are suffering with mental illness themselves. So it isn't, you know, we think of us as, like, you know, people judging the person who has mental illness, but sometimes it's the person themselves who are feeling that way, right?
Absolutely. You know, the person themselves are part of our culture, part of the society, and they have been raised more or less, or fed the culture message that they're defective, that being mentally ill is a weakness of character. It used to be thought and acted upon, still is to some degree, that the person is just deficient in their character as a reason for their having certain symptoms, especially when they're major mental illness symptoms. But even less severe symptoms, just reacting to life, anxiety problems, it's very common for people to have a basic belief that that person is weak, is inferior, and then that's associated with avoid them.
It's also interesting how this shows up even in more subtle ways. So, for example, over the years, there have probably been hundreds of times that I'll be having a conversation with a patient, and I might suggest increasing the dose, let's say, of an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety medicine. And people will sometimes express a reluctance to increase a dose, as if somehow they feel better about being on a lower dose of medicine than on a higher dose, regardless of, you know, what that means in any absolute terms. But it's almost like they get they're being dragged kicking and screaming. So, you know, they've certainly come to see me, obviously. They overcome the stigma to that degree. And yet there's a ratcheting or a more incremental, let's say, effect that also we experience as clinicians and as patients. If somebody's you know, somebody might feel better about being seen once every 2 weeks for therapy, but if you suggested seeing them once a week, say, you know, what am I, crazy? I mean, it's, you know, it's So it could be subtle or not so subtle.
Jenny?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. People look at the dosage of a medicine like a scorecard, a grade that they have, and they want to try to achieve less medicine, then I'm not so bad, not so sick.
Right. Medication seems to me to have an even more stigmatized feeling to it for lots and lots of people. I also just wanted to throw in there on top of Mark's description of stigma that we as humans and as mammals have a biological imperative to connect to other people and to be part of a group. And so if you're in a group that particularly stigmatizes mental illness or medication taking, you're going to be even less likely to go and seek help. So I'm thinking people of color, I'm thinking first responders of all sorts. I don't know about you guys, but they sneak into my office. I have police officers and firefighters who come from other towns or even off Cape so as not to be seen by other firefighters, and only when they are at their wit's end.
Another we'll get to at some point, but we might as well bring that up now. Aside from the stigma, there's the career implications, right? So, you know, you're talking about first responder, police officer who maybe has this idea he or she would like to become a sergeant or move up the ranks, and they're worried that any kind of record of mental illness would impact their career. And it's not, I'm sure it's not just police officers. Jonathan or Mark, do you see that in your practices?
One of the great benefits of the virtual mental health practices that the pandemic has permitted or required is the ability, and I'm thinking right now of a police officer that I began seeing over this past year who I've never set eyes on, and he's never set eyes on me, and he's never had to come to my office. So he could be parked in his car outside of a Dunkin' Donuts or wherever and talk to me, and that enables people to not worry about who they might see in a waiting room or who might see them, maybe more relevant. That's more relevant. So the real explosion in telehealth has actually been somewhat beneficial to allowing people who feel stigmatized and awkward and self-conscious to access services. And in fact, you hear on the radio and on TV advertisements for telehealth companies, and they emphasize how, you know, you can be in your pajamas, you can be in the comfort of your own home. Nobody has to know that you're actually receiving help.
Yeah. One of the things you made me think of saying that is like the community health centers, a lot of now they have everything under one roof. So you're seen walking in there. They don't know if you're walking in for a mental health appointment or a physical appointment, in some cases a dental appointment. So it does take some of that away. But this whole fear of shame is really powerful.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I am also thinking that, I'm sorry to harp on the police and firefighter, but I'm thinking also sort of our country right now and the ways in which PTSD makes people behave more violently sometimes or more erratically. And the two groups that we're most concerned with, people of color and police officers, are the ones who are the least likely to seek help. And some studies have police officers with up to 32% of them having some version of PTSD. Yeah. And the, just for a comparison, general population is 12%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they're in the midst of trauma, you know, day in and day out. That's what their task with, that's their task. Take care of trauma, stop it, control
it. What about this power of the fear of shame?
Well, I think it's, at least the way I look at it, I think it's deeply rooted in evolution because it's very, like Jenny was saying, we're driven and wired and evolved to be in groups, to be affiliated, because that is protection. That is survival, really. If you are extruded from a group, you can die. So think of the primitive people on the plain somewhere thousands and thousands of years ago. If somebody was behaving badly, they might be left behind the next time the group goes foraging, and they starve. What's at stake is survival if you're not accepted by the group. It's not just a cosmetic event. that you've been extruded. It has a deep meaning rooted to our basic survival instincts. That means that shame is exceedingly powerful, and how we appear to others is really probably, I would say, 90%, I'm just guessing, 90% of our mental concerns. You think about your inner talk as you go through the day. I bet you the majority of it has to do with how you're being seen at the moment, and are you being, are you acceptable? Are you saying something dumb and stupid and then get extruded for that? You feel ashamed for that. So shame is a basic driver of human behaviors.
It's interesting to see also how the shift from a more psychodynamic interpretation of symptoms to a more biological interpretation of symptoms also bears on this. So, for example, in the days of Freud, where, you know, problems like obsessive compulsive disorder or anxiety might be, you know, traced, you know, in most cases wrongly to early toilet training or breastfeeding experiences or separation from mom. I mean, that did nothing but encourage stigma, whether it was to some degree true or not. As we've had come to have a more biological understanding of so many illnesses, including OCD, PTSD now is now being revealed in many ways to be so much brain-based, and how one's brain neurology, you know, actually is physically altered by PTSD experiences. So these are ways that we have hope to reduce the stigmatization. So, and in fact, you know, and I'm sure all three of us, the clinicians here, have had many, many times that people have come into our offices and spoken about, asking almost hopefully, I have a chemical imbalance, right? I have a chemical disorder. That people don't want to think that there's something wrong with their soul or something wrong with their spirit or something wrong with their character. They would like to actually be relieved to hear that it's their serotonin that needs to be boosted. And doctor, if you could give me that that Zoloft or that Prozac, you know, I'll be all set. This is also a way to destigmatize illness.
I'm glad you brought that up, because from a personal standpoint, I have really I participated in an experience, something that really our profession should be indicted for. And that was when I trained in the early 1970s, everything was psychoanalytic. And if you dared to pick up a prescription pad and write a script for somebody, you were a failure as a doctor, because you didn't get to the root of the problem. You didn't analyze, or you didn't work well enough as a therapist to cure the person. And the psychiatrists in the field that were biologically oriented, who were constantly just kind of listening to patients and coming up with the best medicine at the time, and they were limited then, but the best medicine at the time that might match the symptoms, they were looked down upon in our profession. They were less than, they were stigmatized. It was only until the 80s and especially the 90s that attitude shifted. When I was in residency for 3 years, I had 1 hour of a seminar on medication, 1 hour of one seminar over 3 years. Whereas the people that were getting trained at Mass General at the time, I was at Tufts, the people that were trained at Mass General were getting biology. They knew how to use medications better than I did. So when I came out, I had to rely on the PDR to teach me, physician's desk reference, that big book of drugs.
Also, I just want to say that there's non-medication ways of shifting your biology. Just as someone who doesn't medicate, but who definitely refers people for medication when they need it, but that there's other ways, and for those people who are terrified of medication, there are other ways to shift your biology besides medication.
Absolutely. They do the same thing. They just approach it from a different way. Talking therapies engage the front part of the brain, which modifies what goes on unconsciously and the into the lower parts of the brain. The medicines kind of work directly on those lower parts of the brain in terms of altering circuits.
And I do EMDR, which also is not quite talk therapy, but
absolutely.
We also shouldn't ignore the fact that, to such a large degree, our diagnostic scaffolding that we use in the world of mental health is the product, at least as much of our culture as it is. Let's not forget that homosexuality was actually classified as an illness until way too recently. In fact, Mark, when you were a resident, given that you're so much older than I am, when you were a resident, homosexuality was a DSM-2 or 1 diagnosis.
That's right. It was a subject to change, a notion of stigmatization.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a disorder that or disease that was subject to treatment to change. So I did come from that area, that era, and thankfully it's been buried.
And now still people of color are diagnosed way more often with psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar than people who are not of color, people who are white.
Yeah. Yeah.
Women are more likely to be diagnosed with those as well.
Yeah, borderline personality. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, in the shame thing, I wanted to also mention that the other thing I see is people who come in and are ashamed of how small they feel their problems are. You know, they're like, I know that my, you know, father beating me every day wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to someone. And I'm like,
yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about the stigma of mental illness. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are discussing the stigma of mental illness. With us this morning is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Do you sometimes think, and you sort of, somebody touched on this, that somebody decides, okay, I need some professional help, and they go in and they get a diagnosis. Sometimes that's such a relief because it isn't what you thought it was, right? I know years ago, I thought, I wake up a lot. I have insomnia, but I didn't know it was insomnia at the time. And so I thought, maybe I'm depressed. I mean, my mother was depressed. Maybe I have depression. You know, I'm tired a lot. And so I actually went to see professional help. I was in there like 10 minutes, and he said, go to a sleep doctor. This is not your problem. I was like, I paid for an hour. I got 10 minutes, but I was really relieved. I go, oh, it's just insomnia. So I'm wondering if you have that experience with some of your patients who go like, oh, thank goodness. It's just, whatever it might be.
I have that with a couple of my, particularly people who have dissociative identity disorder, what used to be called multiple personality. They have lost time. They behave very differently in different circumstances. Friends will say to them, I don't know who you are sometimes. And it's very, very confusing and disturbing to them. And when they get the diagnosis plus hope that they can do better, feel better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very relieving. Sometimes very shaming. Sometimes also very shaming. Because that's a big diagnosis.
But. Yeah, that is. Yeah. Yeah.
I think as psychiatrists, we don't have, well, I'll speak for myself. I don't have that experience nearly as often as I wish I did. I can still remember on one hand, I think, the number of times somebody's come in only to have me be able to really reassure them that they don't have a mental health problem at all and what they're experiencing is normal. But I think that's because typically before someone comes to see a psychiatrist, they've seen at least a couple of other people first. I mean, people don't come to see a psychiatrist often until they really feel like they've run out of options, unfortunately. Right. So they've typically seen their primary care doctor. They've probably or possibly seen a psychologist or a LICSW, a social worker, or a LMHC, whatever. We tend to see people who are kind of have been through the ringer a bit, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had the same experience and echo just what you said.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about how stigma impacts self-confidence.
It's like acid on it. It deteriorates, it erodes it, because you're adopting a view that a culture has toward you, or you're interpreting it as a view that you are deficient, that you're not worthy, that you're not really part of the group, and you can't be, you're a misfit, things along those lines. That is, all those statements I just made are right next door to poor self-confidence. It drives you into a corner where you don't want to venture out into the world because you're going to get knocked down. That's the belief. That's the persistent negative belief about oneself. When that happens, hopefully the person will get some treatment for it, because there is treatment for it. It's very effective. Cognitive therapy is very effective along these lines to help the person realistically get a perspective on their deeply held beliefs, which are just what they've been fed and what they've licked off the grass, so to speak, it didn't belong on the grass to begin with. Mm-hmm. That's the goal. I mean, that's the method of therapy, is to help them get a better perspective.
Also, make the point that we know that suicide rates are quite high among psychiatrists and I believe other mental health providers. And what I find most interesting about that is that one way that people who are struggling or suffering cope with that is to become caretakers. Mm-hmm. I've known so many people in the world of mental health providers who themselves, it turns out really were struggling behind the scenes, but who really had focused all their attention and energy on taking care of other people as a way of feeling better. One of my very favorite NPR shows, among my many favorite NPR shows, Only a Game, had a wonderful episode about a college basketball player who committed suicide during the season. Everybody was shocked. Everybody, his mother, his girlfriend, all of his teammates. He was known to be a guy who always was looking after everybody else, was always cheering for his fellow players, was always looking for ways to make other people around him be better and feel better. And it turned out he actually left a note explaining that he never felt that he was able to turn to anyone for help, that he felt that if he had done so, people would have looked down on him and seen him as weak. And it was just a very, very sad story, but not unique by any stretch of the imagination. So I think that, almost being a full-time caretaker by personality style is almost a risk factor for struggling inside and needs to be considered.
Yeah, I think mental health professionals should be included amongst first responders. We certainly all felt like first responders throughout this pandemic, I think.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, just to point out, there's a very good side to having been on the other side and experience it as a patient or as having the same kind of symptoms. It makes you a better therapist. It makes you a better helper. Because you've been there, you know those, you know what it's like to be vulnerable, really. Mm-hmm. Being a professional is kind of a false way of guarding against being vulnerable. If you can appreciate that side of your experience and that side of yourself, you get to be a better therapist.
Yeah, the good thing about analytic training, Mark, we all had to go through analysis ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right.
Yep. Go ahead, Mindy.
I'll give you the number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Go ahead, Jenny.
The other thing about stigma and self-esteem is that it directly impacts performance. There was a fascinating study that I just read about this week where when President Obama was elected president that year, GRE grades for people of color went up significantly just by him being elected president. Because that was a different message to the people of color in the United States that yes, you can achieve the highest office. And so the stigma was removed temporarily and made a big difference. So.
With all of that, stress of being a stress, right? When you're a stigmatized person, there's a lot of stress, which can become chronic stress. And we all know the threats of stress, right? Being chronically stressed is not good for any part of your health.
That's right. Medical health, and certainly psychological health. I think it's very common. The root of depression is just the end result of chronic, unrelenting stress in which the individual has been made to feel as if, and indeed sometimes absolutely is, helpless in changing. It's bad for us all around. We know from biology what the chemical avenues are that do damage to the body from stress. So it's not just an association. There's a real established evidence for an established pathway of biological chemistry to produce bodily damage adds to the suffering or at least keeps it going.
And you doctors can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that especially early chronic stress, but any kind of chronic stress can turn the sympathetic nervous system on sort of so that it's permanently switched on, which is where we get sort of the hypervigilance or the collapse into depression.
That's right. The sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight nervous system. And that has a number of different hormonal components and neurological components. But being turned on all the time is exceedingly damaging, and it is not compatible with survival, really, if it is unrelenting. Absolutely, that's one of the pathways.
You know, it's interesting, too, that I think that my training was largely a pretty solid mixture of the biological and the psychodynamic. I trained a few years after Mark and at Mass General, and at that point, biology had definitely entered the scene, but there was still a lot of psychodynamic training. But we were taught the traditional way of being a blank slate, of being aloof, of having an office with not few, if any, personal effects. The idea was to almost create a kind of sterile environment in which the patient would feel, he wouldn't be triggered, if that's a word, or stimulated by anything that was personal about the doctor, the therapist. And I think that actually encouraged stigmatization to some degree, as opposed to having a more normal, like you're human, I'm a human, we share many of the same kinds of experiences because we are both human. We can sometimes joke around. It's not such a crazy thing if I were to have a picture of my family in the office because people have families. I mean, you know, and I think that as we've come into the 21st century or even the end of the 20th century, I know for myself, certainly, I am a very real person to my patients, and I think they actually benefit immensely from that. much more than any downside to me being a real person. I mean, I try to be very careful not to project and not to assume. But I also, I think that there's real value in being a real person. And that, that was never the traditional way that therapists were taught, whether you're an analyst or just a psychotherapist. That's not how you were taught traditionally.
I agree 100%. The traditional way capitalized on the power dynamic and made the patient, rob the patient of any of a sense of power and influence. It was like coming in and praying at the foot of a priest or a somebody with power. The treatment that works is exactly what you're talking about, Jonathan, is the genuine encounter between two individuals that really makes a difference. And that happens throughout medicine. You ask patients who they liked as a doctor, what surgeon they would choose. They most frequently will say, gee, I really like that guy. He really talked to me. He explained to it. Mm-hmm. He made me understand, as opposed to the aloof, very technically competent individual who can perform the motor tasks of the surgery, but they leave a lot to be desired when it comes to really taking care of the individual. And it's that connection that is so important in all of our professions, where the patient has a sense that they are being noticed, they're being accepted, and they're being valued as they are, as opposed to their pleading at the foot of some kind of power on high.
Yep. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break.
Our relationship to the environment is tied to where we live and the connection we have to that place. That's driven many to fight for clean beaches and plastic-free oceans. But others, including many people of color, feel excluded by the mainstream environmental movement. So who's pushing the movement to focus on environmental justice? We'll find out next time on 1A.
This morning at 10 on CAI. Support for CAI comes from you and Slade Mortgage, a locally owned Cape Cod mortgage broker, guiding borrowers through purchase, refinance, and reverse mortgage lending in both Massachusetts and Florida, serving customers for over 24 years. SladeMortgage.com.
And Habitat for Humanity of Cape Cod's Restores on Gifford Street in Falmouth and White's Path in South Yarmouth, carrying furniture, building materials, and appliances repurposed for the good of the environment. Details at RestoreCapeCod.org.
Some people get bored watching baseball.
Chuck Sturdivant, general manager of the Bourne Braves.
You know, years ago, I could sit and watch a no-hitter and be excited about it that I got to see one. But today, the younger kids, they're so much more used to more activity like the video games and so on. That's why I think it's so important to be at a game like here, because it's a lot different than watching it on TV.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the stigma of mental illness with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got an email from Richard with an excellent question. He says, can your guest speak to the stigma of seeking mental health care among ethnic minorities and the value of having a therapist of similar ethnicity? Is that beneficial? I would think yes, but what do you think?
So it actually depends. It depends on what your internal representation about your ethnicity is. And so I think that it also depends on the therapist's willingness to acknowledge, for instance, white privilege. So if somebody comes in and is a person of, I have a fair number of people of color in my practice, and they come in and I try to make a space where they can talk about their sense of difference and what I have that they don't have and what they have that I don't have. And some really prefer to have a white therapist because of their own internalized racism. And so we try to work through that and hopefully get to a point where maybe they could try a therapist from their same difference. But I think it's more, yes, sometimes it's absolutely critical that they see someone who's similar, of a similar background. But I think it's more important for therapists to educate themselves about how to be open to feeling in different positions, sometimes disempowered.
I mean, this is a huge problem in medicine, that it's been really now very well established that Black patients get shortchanged when they see white doctors or nurse practitioners, that the amount of time that a Black doctor spends with a Black patient is quantitatively documented to be longer. Maybe it's a little different in the mental health world than it is in the medical world, but I doubt it. Unfortunately, of course, there are so few mental health providers of color. I'd like to think that this is very slowly changing, and maybe now in the current environment it will change a little bit more rapidly. But there's no question that people are going to feel more comfortable in general, not to contradict what Jenny said, but in general, to feel more comfortable with people with whom they share a cultural heritage.
You're welcome to contradict me. I think those are both true. I think that's all true.
Yeah. I read an article from a Black man that talked about his experience in terms of accepting the need for mental health treatment. And he pointed out that the Black culture teaches from an early age, you got to be careful in this world. Black people don't have it easy. You have to watch where you step. You have to watch how you behave. You can't appear vulnerable because you can be taken advantage of and used and enslaved, whatever. That would speak against being seeking mental health treatment. So that's that self-stigma that is operative there. But it has a racial complication along with it.
Well, and speaking of traditions within psychology, along with homosexual people, people of color were considered more primitive. They were considered, and women, and less evolved, less independent. Independence was, we now know that co-regulation is vital. But back then it was like, we want to work towards independence. At the cost of all else. And so, that also, of course, is going to make people less likely to seek help. Or become therapists, truthfully. Yeah. Why would a person of color become a therapist if the field was going to tell them that they were more primitive?
Let's talk a little bit about seeking help. I have two thoughts. Before we get to kind of barriers to service, I'm just thinking, sometimes people have a misconception about what that is, right? In my own experience, when my youngest brother, when we were much younger, clearly he was having some difficulty as a teenager. And I said to my father, he needs to see somebody. You need to bring him for some mental health services. And my father's response was, he's not crazy. He's just having a tougher time growing up than the rest of you. And his thing was, you don't seek mental help unless you're crazy, which there are some people who believe that. So let's talk about the reality. And if somebody is struggling, what first steps they might take or look at to seek help. There's a lot of choices. Do you go to a therapist? Do you go to a psychologist? Do you go to a psychiatrist? It can be a little bit overwhelming, I think, for somebody who's struggling. Who wants to take that on?
Well, you're
right. It is complicated. People tend to have certain biases, which I think steer them in the wrong direction. So, for example, people will often think, a psychiatrist is going to be better than a nurse practitioner. Well, there are great nurse practitioners, and there are bad nurse practitioners, and there are great psychiatrists, and there are bad psychiatrists, just as there are great lawyers and bad lawyers, and great architects and bad architects. So there's that kind of prejudice. But I do think that just in terms of, what kind of person do I need to see? Do I need to see a counselor? Do I need medicine? People can't be expected to know what the proper treatment is, but it would be great if there were a way for us to have an algorithm that everybody understood, even if you don't understand what an algorithm is, so they would know where to start and how to proceed to find
the person. And I, you know, this is something I have said, Mindy, I've suggested this as a topic unto itself, because it's a very large topic, is how does one find the right person? In the old days, the phone book was a notoriously bad way to find a person. And I, when I was seeing somebody new and it said on the intake sheet that they got my name out of the phone book, I shuddered and just prayed that it turned out okay. You know, talking to a friend who has received services is a pretty decent way to start, or talking to your primary care doctor is also a pretty decent way to start. Although, again, that there's nothing foolproof about either of those avenues. It's difficult. I'm interested in what Mark and Jenny think.
You know, I tend to say to people that counselors and social workers are trained to do talk therapy, more or less. And so that's our training. Psychologists are trained on top of that to do testing, and psychiatrists are trained on top of that to do medication. And while, of course, there are psychiatrists who do also talk therapy, sounds like you guys are two of them, a lot of psychiatrists really just medicate. And so that's kind of the algorithm I give people when they're looking. And then I always say to people, you know, make three appointments, meet with three different people, because as we've all been saying, the relationship is a huge part of the cure. So if you are uncomfortable with that person, it's probably not going to work.
Yes, I always compare that to dating. I say, you know, sometimes you have to kiss quite a few frogs before you find a prince, whether you're male or female. And I think the idea of making multiple appointments is good, although I think for most people, they see even having a single interview in which they are telling their history is in itself daunting and exhausting.
Yeah.
So I guess I prefer the serial method to the simultaneous method. And I encourage people, don't settle. If you don't feel like somebody's really listening and they get who you are, do not continue with that person. Because I see, you know, we all see people who go on for months and years seeing the same person and not really feeling satisfied and not really feeling like there's a connection. And it's just such a terrible, sad waste of time and money and energy.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, when I feel the call from somebody who hasn't had experience in a treatment before, I just ask them, right, what are you looking for? Are you looking for medication? Do you think that medicine is going to play a part? And if they say yes, I'll steer them at least initially toward a prescriber. And if not, then please see a therapist. That's where you need to start. And then you and the therapist decide whether medicine can be part of your treatment or not. Put the control really is with the patient.
Yeah. What do you think about, going forward, if we were to, and you touched on this earlier, if we were to look at mental illness as a brain disease, right? Instead of, we have all these labels for it. But if we started talking about it in those terms, wouldn't that go a long way to not only reducing stigma, but also helping people go, you know what, this isn't my fault. It's a brain disease. I need to get, just like I have a heart problem, or I got to go see a doctor, right? You're all nodding your head. So what are your thoughts on that? Language can be a big part of the solution here, right?
Yeah, language is, it defines how you, what image you take away from the communication. So brain disease is definitely a valid point to make, and it also has evidence for it. It might not have started with a brain problem, a biological chemical problem, because your experience in life changes your brain. So in other words, your experience has created a brain disease of which certain symptoms are manifest. But you're describing basically all mental disorders as a brain disease is accurate. And you're at least being openly honest about what the phenomenon is.
I might call it more chemical imbalance rather than a brain disease. Brain disease is kind of frightening. I felt myself even kind of like my heart kind of. So our brains are so important to us that we feel like if there's a disease of our brain, that's going to take that away from us.
Maybe, I'll go with chemical imbalance, Jenny.
I think also we don't want to medicalize every
reason why a person might benefit from seeing a therapist. If somebody's unhappily married or they're frustrated in their job because they don't feel like, you know, they're being treated properly, you know, these are both two among, you know, hundreds of valid reasons to seek out a counselor. And yet they're not, that's not brain disease. It's not even chemical. It's just having someone who's neutral and objective, that it's reasonable. If you're struggling, you don't need to necessarily qualify for a diagnosis of major depression or panic disorder or bipolar. It still can be really helpful to be able to think out loud with somebody who's got their wits about them and can help you reflect on what they hear you saying.
I read a story, an article many years ago about a study that was done at a college, of course, for college students always being studied, where they were asked to either do nothing, write down every day what was going on in their life, or talk into a microphone, just tape what was going on every day. It wasn't even talking to a person. And the people who taped what was going on every day, so that the act of speaking it, were less depressed than the significantly than the people who did nothing, and the writing was somewhere in between, but the speaking, it was interesting to me that the use of words and vocalization helped people be less depressed.
That's the old valid aspect of psychoanalysis, just the anamnesis, it's called, you know, just speaking out your history is beneficial and relieves a lot of stress, just saying in words what's going on in your head, bouncing back.
A woman interviewed on Fresh Air just yesterday or the day before, who an author who said, it's really hard to lie to yourself when you're writing, you know, what you live. And that's undoubtedly just as true, maybe truer, if you're actually saying it out loud. Yeah. And just hearing yourself speak about or seeing in words what your experience is can be extremely helpful. People talk about journaling as a very powerful tool, but it makes sense what you say, Jenny, that the study would have shown that actually saying things out loud in some ways is even more potent.
Yeah. I'm wondering, in the last few minutes that we have, talking about ways to reduce stigma, and I think we've begun this journey, right? I mean, we have a lot of celebrities and famous people who are coming forward and talking about their struggles, which help people go, hey, that's just like me. And so what are some of the other ways that we think we might be able to reduce this stigma?
I think leaders within groups, again, going back to the sort of idea that it's a biological imperative for us to belong to a group, that if we have faith leaders, or we have chiefs of police, or we have, book club leaders, you know, whatever it is, people who are leaders within their groups say, this is a valid, important, easy, not painless, but certainly, you know, doable and can really make your life better thing, that would be a big help.
The quote solution to racism, to stigma, is contact with the other group, the stigmatized, or the racial minorities. Anything that you can do that brings you in some kind of interaction with people with mental illness, or just talking with others about it, you'd be surprised how many people will pipe up about their experience. Same thing with alcohol. People go to AA and they're surprised at seeing who's there. But that helps destigmatize their alcoholism.
Jonathan, you got the last minute.
I know that there are some police departments, getting back to, you know, what Jenny's been referring to, and other institutions that now encourage or even require that people have an evaluation or have somebody to talk to if they have faced a really horrific situation, like a fireman who's been to a plane crash, for example. I had to evaluate such a person, or a policeman who's come across a dead child. So the leader, I think, you know, leadership is really powerful and important. The EAP programs that guarantee confidentiality and that are widely advertised within institutions, you know, so there's a lot of different ways that it's all been so incremental. It'd be great if it were being done at an accelerated pace, but we do see signs of improvement.
All right. Psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, and social worker Jenny Putman, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it, your time this morning. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.